Good morning. My name is Francesca Barnes, and I am a non-executive director here at Coutts. I am delighted to welcome such a large number of clients to this online event. Lord Waldegrave, our chairman, is championing the Coutts in Conversation series to ensure that we stay connected with you through this difficult time. And we do hope you continue to enjoy and learn from these sessions. Lord Waldegrave has given me the absolute honour of comparing today's session dedicated to the Mental Health Awareness Week that we recognise at the moment. Being a member of the Coutts Board, I know how important mental health is to our employees, who voted to support two excellent mental health charities this year, Place to Be and MQ. The theme for Mental Health Awareness Week is kindness. And I've been overwhelmed by our staff's continued thought and support for others, particularly in the last couple of months. And crucially, it won't stop there. As we reflect on how to recover from this pandemic, we need to think about how we can build back better to a kinder and more inclusive world. Sometimes referred to as the second pandemic, mental health issues are coming to the fore in this challenging time. The Office of National Statistics recently noted that nearly half of people in Great Britain over age 16 are reporting a high anxiety. Many of you, understandably, may be experiencing similar levels of anxiety for your family, your businesses, your employees, and the future. And yet, at the same time, our clients have selflessly demonstrated greater generosity and kindness than ever before, asking us how best they can get involved in charitable initiatives. So despite the power of kindness, though, it is sometimes hard to keep optimistic. We're all experiencing fundamental changes to the way we live, the way we interact with each other, how we worry about our own health and that of our loved ones. But we are not alone. And today, to help us give some perspective and practical tips, I am truly honoured to welcome first Terry Waite. Terry is a humanitarian, author, and the co-founding president of Hostage International. For most of his life, he has worked in international affairs, spending much of his time in many of the world's conflict zones. It was in Beirut that he was captured in 1987. And spent an almost unimaginable 5 years in captivity, most of which was in solitary confinement. And I'm truly delighted to welcome Sir Anthony Selden. Sir Anthony is one of Britain's leading contemporary historians, educationalists, commentators, and political authors. Indeed, he has written the inside story on our last five prime ministers, so we can only assume a sixth will be along shortly. Alongside his prolific books on contemporary history, Sir Anthony also penned the book Beyond Happiness, which we'll reference today. He co-founded Action for Happiness and is the president of IPEN, the International Positive Education Network. So to everybody, but particularly to our speakers, welcome and thank you both so much for joining us. Just a quick housekeeping note before we start. We've had a large volume of pre-submitted questions, huge thanks, key themes from which I've woven into the conversation today. And towards the latter part of the session, we will also turn to some more specific questions and hopefully some live questions as we receive them. I am, in addition to my role as a non-exec director here at Coutts, also the chair of the Risk Committee, and as such, I've given thought to the risk that my broadband connection might fall, and I just want you to know I have a contingency plan in place, just in case you wonder why I'm suddenly swapped in gender. Okay, now, gentlemen, Terry, I would love to start with you, please. And my question to you, my opening question is, the UK public associates you with something quite profoundly traumatic in your life. You're being taken as a hostage, taken on trust, as you called your book, which was at a period of time that is now some decades ago. So I'd love to ask, how does it feel to you in retrospect? And for those of us who haven't experienced trauma, and perhaps are feeling the weight of change brought on by COVID-19, it would be really interesting to hear how you reflect on it today.
Well, very nice to be with you this morning. And thank you for joining in and allowing me to join with you. Let me go back a little bit to give a bit of background. I first began my work as a hostage negotiator through very difficult circumstances. I was living and working in Uganda at the time, and I was acting as an advisor to the first African Archbishop of Uganda. By the way, I'm a layman, I'm not a clergyman, and I've worked from a church base much of my life. And it was in Uganda that I first came across real brutality. General Amin came to power, and many of my colleagues were thrown into prison, and a good number of them were murdered. And it was my first negotiation at that level with Amin to at least get some people freed from that terrible situation. But it opened my eyes to the brutalities of that, and I didn't realize at the time just how deeply it had affected me, the fact of seeing people actually murdered before my eyes did have quite a profound effect. Anyway, I went on and worked in most troubled spots of the world, and then was invited by the then Archbishop of Canterbury, Robert Runcie, to be his advisor and to travel with him and to be responsible for his ecclesiastical and political exchanges around the world. And it was then that the hostage crisis emerged in the 70s, 80s. And I was involved because people turned to Lambeth and said, "Can you help us? We're not getting any help." So I did my best. I went out to Iran and negotiated with Revolutionary Guards. I negotiated personally with Gaddafi, and in those instances was successful, obtaining the release of people without payment, without any compromise of any principle that one had, so fair dealing. People said you'll never be able to talk to these people, but they were wrong. It was possible to talk with them. But you know, if you do a dangerous job like that, you always stand a chance of something going wrong. You can either be killed or captured. And you take note of that fact, but you don't dwell on it. But if the worst happens, then you have to be able to face it and take your own responsibility for that, not blame other people, because no one has asked you to do this particular work. As it was, through complex political circumstances, things went wrong for me in Beirut. I was negotiating for the release of Western hostages, and I was given an assurance, a promise, that I'd be able to go and see a hostage who was about to die. And I was very leery about that. And I had to decide whether or not to go back. And first of all, let me just say, I'm of the belief that very few people, certainly myself, are full of what you might call altruism. I think when we do something for other people, consciously or unconsciously, we're doing something for ourselves. And in this instance, my feeling was as follows. If I'd been given an opportunity to go and see someone who's about to die, and if that man dies and I haven't been, I'm going to have to live with my conscience for the rest of my life, my own personal motive there. So I went back, to cut a long story short. Instead of being able to see this individual, I was put in an underground cell. And I spent then the next almost 5 years in extreme solitary, no books, no papers, no freedom of movement, chained to the wall, sleeping on the floor, one visit to the bathroom a day, no natural light. I was totally alone. And so there, I'll stop at this point, I think, because I've said enough at this point. But there, then I had to be able to come to terms with an extreme situation. And one of the reasons I'm glad to speak about it today is because I think it is from extreme situations that you can take understandings that are applicable to what we might call normal life or life today. And perhaps during the course of the conversation, one might be able to do that. Rather a lengthy introduction. I hope it's not too long.
No, not at all. It's a fantastic introduction. But, you know, here we are, 30 plus years on. Does it feel real to you? Is it something that you're drawing on daily in your work, or
let me respond to that by saying when I sat down on the floor chained to the wall in the first few hours of captivity, I was angry. I was very angry with myself for taking such a risk. And I was certainly angry with my captors for breaking their word. And, you know, I've written a book, I wrote some poetry and reflections, a book called Out of the Silence. And in that book, there's a very short poem which I wrote about anger. It's anger is like a consuming fire, seeking all whom it may devour. Do not extinguish the flames totally, but calm yourself by the gentle glow of the embers. In other words, saying it's a force which is present and it's within all of us, and we all get angry. And if we allow anger to possess us, it will do us more harm than it does against those whom it's held. But it's something that's there, and the secret is, I suppose, to try and take that force and turn it into a creative direction. But that took time. It didn't come quickly. I mean, for the first week, I didn't eat. There was a way of saying I still have a measure of freedom. So I didn't eat anything for the first week. I just drank water. At the end of the first week, they said, if you don't eat, we shall make you. And by that time, I got more control of my feelings and my anger. The second thing to say about this whole period is that, of course, you have to face chronic uncertainty, chronic fear, because I was tortured, I had a mock execution, and so on. But also, when you are in isolation, when you are in solitary confinement, when you are alone, there is this tendency to become deeply introspective and to look within. And anybody who does that with any degree of honesty and sincerity will find that they're a complex mixture of whatever you may call it, light and dark. And you come across, everyone will come across, the shadow side, the side of which you're not particularly proud. And a danger of that process is that if you allow yourself to dwell and unnecessarily on the shadow side, or if you push it down, somehow you're going to be led into deep depression. And we all know, you know, how chronically fatiguing and debilitating depression is. And I had to face that because I did become very introspective. I took this inner journey. But an inner journey, if you're honest, need not be a devastating experience. It can be a wholesome experience, because what I decided that one had to do was somehow try and work for that greater degree of inner harmony. And people do it in different ways. Some people do it through meditation. Some people do it a variety of ways in which you work for inner harmony. In my way, I did it through language. I have the belief that good language, like good music, has the capacity to breathe harmony into the soul. And therefore I began to write in my head, and I began to write not only books, if you like, which many of which have gone now, have gone from memory, but I wrote poetry as well. And also I've been a lover of music, still am. And so there's no music in the cell, obviously, but I could recollect that and bring it to mind. In other words, that part of the secret of dealing with these situations is to develop a rich and full inner life. And that can be done in situations where you have nothing around you, no material goods, nothing. It can be done.
Perry, that sounds so compelling, so honest. Thank you really very much indeed. And I suspect it has some resonance as I turn now to Anthony. I mean, it's clear that Terry is exceptionally resilient. And in your book, Beyond Happiness, you talk about substantive paths to happiness, doing things that make you feel lighter. Now, unfortunately, we don't have time to run through all of these. I strongly recommend people look at it themselves. But reflecting on the challenges that people are faced with now, what do you think they can do to help themselves build resilience and find joy?
Well, the answer, Francesca, is a lot. But before I dilate on that, can I just say how really thrilled I am to be talking today to this group at Coutts. And I've known William Waltergrave a long time. Rory Tapner is my superb chair at the University of Buckingham, where I'm vice chancellor, and Mo Saeed is on the board and oversees our finances. So I've always had a huge regard for Coutts. Great thrill. Now, the answer is, Francesca, a lot. And listening to Terry's very moving testimony there made me feel that in some ways, though, thank goodness, we'll never know the terror of solitary confinement in Beirut, there are elements of that in lockdown where we are forced to be on our own and to fall back on our own resources and where we have a choice. So when at Wellington College, I introduced happiness classes 15 years ago to, I think, a pretty much unified national scorn, the idea that that would be an appropriate thing for a school to do, least of all a famous academic school, and this would be not helpful. In fact, it did prove very popular. And the core idea there, Francesca, is that we can be the masters and mistresses of our own fate. However bad things are out there, whether in a solitary confinement in Beirut or whether in our flats and apartments and homes or whatever misfortune might happen to us, and it's a very difficult time for many people, and many people listening will have children at university and schools who are finding life difficult, there is a choice. And there is always grounds for optimism. We can always do things. So when 10 years ago I founded Action for Happiness, we based it on the steps that we can take to improve the quality of our own lives. And by the way, to make ourselves happier is not a selfish thing. The happier that we make ourselves, the more energy and trust and joy and affirmation we bring to people around us. It's not like pleasure, which is a self-centered thing. To make ourselves happy, or harmony was the word that Terry used, the more harmonious we can make our own selves, to be harmonious with ourselves, to be in harmony with our colleagues online at the moment, often with our families and friends, to be harmonious indeed with nature, this will help to make us happier, and it builds resilience. And every time we succumb and give in to, oh, I don't know, that glass of gin early on, or we get snappy, we lose our temper, we give in to despair, we are losing resilience. Every time we show nobility, that we just pause and say, no, I'm not going to let this get on top of me. I'm going to just come forward. I'm going to be positive. Then we're building. Resilience is like an up escalator. And the more we take decisions in our own lives, recognizing that we are the author of our own story, the more we take those courageous steps, the easier life will be the more we take the shallow, the wrong, the nasty path, the more we descend, and the more difficult and ultimately hellish life becomes.
There's so much in there. And one of the things that I personally have found extraordinarily valuable since discovering mindfulness is taking the time daily to, I describe it as get in touch with myself.
I think there's a great deal of truth in that. The path is a path to simplicity, to harmony, to acceptance of ourselves. I mean, goodness, isn't that difficult to accept ourselves and to accept other people, not trying to change them into something that they're not. Accepting, again, as Terry was saying there, with that sense of just being at one with ourself. And to sometimes just to breathe in and breathe out and center ourselves, to collect ourselves, so that we don't write off a snarky email or have a be ratty on the conversation or cut somebody up at home for not washing the dishes. We can just let that kind of go over us and we can recenter ourselves and to come back and be the best version of ourselves. And just taking time out during the day is a very good way of doing that. And of course at work, you know, it really works. We used to think that all this well-being stuff affected productivity in firms negatively. We now know that those companies and institutions that take well-being seriously see their productivity rise. And in schools, we used to think that exams were all that mattered, and like at universities and this la-la land of happiness, it's just guff. But we now know that the schools that prioritize teacher and staff and pupil well-being see their performance rise and they become gentler, wiser, better communities, institutions where people want to stay, not to hop off to the next job. They want to join it. KPIs go in the right direction the more that we prioritize our well-being, and I think that self-acceptance is key to that.
Thank you both very much. So now what I'm going to do is slightly shift to talk about how you've both been inspired by your own experiences to help others, and in that process you've gone on to found organizations that support well-being. Terry with Hostage International and Why Care, Anthony Action for Happiness and IPEN. Can you tell us what motivated you to support others, and how does this give you happiness? So what motivated you to support others and how this gives you happiness? And I'm going to come to that.
Can I just, before coming to that precise point, just build a little on what Anthony has said? There's a short story, a small story. In captivity, I have one visit to the bathroom a day. And in those 5 or 6 minutes, I had to shower or wash my clothes. It's just a very, very quick visit. In this bathroom, and I was on the third or fourth floor of a bombed out building, high up on the wall, there was a window which was covered by a metal, a wooden shutter. And the wooden shutter was normally padlocked. No chance of getting through there, obviously. But on one occasion, I went in, and the padlock had been left undone. And I clambered up, and I looked down on the street below. And it was the first time I'd seen the outside world in years. And there was a lady walking along with a large bunch of flowers. And it was the first time I'd seen such a display of colour for a long, long time. And the rather trite saying came to mind, the best things in life are free. Mm-hmm. And I know it's a trite saying, but at that point, I appreciated that. Building on what Anthony said, somehow to take it heightened my appreciation of the natural world, of the world which is surrounding us, which is open and free to us. Here in the village where I live, one can appreciate and see, I've seen over the past weeks, the trees come into bloom. And then I've also reflected on the fact that I now must make a greater effort not to rape the environment, to be more in tune with the environment, to be more, because part of our illness in the world today is that we're out of tune with our natural surroundings. We're divorcing ourselves from, I use the analogy in the past. In the old days, people walked without shoes. They then put on sandals, and the next step was to cover the earth with concrete. You can see what I'm saying, divorcing ourselves. Now, the other point I just make, also in the village, we've had a stronger sense of community, even though it's always been a good community. And there's been a great sense of caring for each other. People come and do my shopping each week. But going back to captivity, I became, towards the end of my experience, very ill. In the last few weeks, I had a very bad bronchial infection. And I was put in to be with other hostages, three others. And it was a pain for them because I had to sit up day and night with my back against the wall, struggling for breath. I was going to die. In fact, I did lapse into unconsciousness on two or three occasions. But at night, when I was gasping for breath, one of the hostages, Terry Anderson, who was chained nearest to me, he was still a fair distance away, but he was nearest to me, he leaned across and he simply put his hand on mine. He didn't say anything, just put his hand on mine. And that was a tremendous comfort. You know, and one looks back on that and says, well, I've often thought when I've been to see somebody in hospital or they've been critically ill, what to say. And I recognize it doesn't really matter. What really matters is the fact that someone else is concerned and with you. And that is true, you know, that's where, in a sense, we all have this responsibility in our workplace or wherever to build compassionate community. Doesn't mean to say we have to be soft. It doesn't mean to say we don't have to be critical. Of course we do. We have to be. We have to keep ourselves mentally alive. But there is such a thing as a compassionate community.
And I couldn't agree with you more. And you've just articulated the whole principle behind kindness in that beautiful story just then. And I can also see completely why it is that you then go on to co-found something like Hostage International, because you
I should get round to your question. But just very quickly to answer that, when I came out, many people were approaching me for help who'd been hostages or who were hostage families. And I decided I did my best. And then I decided that we had to institutionalize this so it had an existence beyond me. And over the past years now, we have been in touch with hundreds of people, returning hostages and families, offering them support because they are put into an extraordinarily difficult position. Most of our work is done very confidentially. We don't publicize it, which makes it one of the things difficult for fundraising because we're not widely known. We have a very effective and good relationship with the Foreign Office, the British Foreign Office, and with foreign governments too, because we are international. And we appoint somebody, when somebody approaches us, one of our team will work with that family or that individual for as long as required. And this is a totally free service. We don't charge at all for it. But these are tough times. I mean, we're in, like all charities, we are facing major difficulties. We've had to reduce staff and put some people on furlough. But the need is there still. And it's something that I'm really glad that I was able to at least get moving years ago.
Yeah, thank you. And Anthony, you too have worked to create organisations to support young and indeed all people. How has this, if I may borrow your language, given you happiness?
Well, because being helping other people simply makes us happy. So 10 years ago, along with Lord Richard Layard of London School of Economics and Jeff Mulgan, who was head of strategy for some years in Downing Street, the three of us came together and said we needed to found a national body to make everybody aware that there are evidence-based, deeply evidence-based steps that we can take in our own lives to make ourselves and our communities and our organisations happier, to make them flourish. We now have 180,000 members in 90 different countries who are part of our network. We have an acronym, Francesca, called Great Dream. Everything I do always seems to have to be 10 or be a multiplier of 10. And the 10 factors in Great Dream, great stands for G for giving, and R for relationships, and E for exercise. So the two words Great Dream, I won't go through all of them, spell out, it's on the Action for Happiness website, spell out steps that we can all take to make ourselves happier. And it's interesting, the first one is giving. The more that we can give to others, the happier it makes us. We might be walking down a street, somebody's dropped a glove, we pick the glove up, we give it to them, and there will be, you can't help it, you will experience a glow of happiness as that person will also experience. And conversely, the unkinder we are to other people, the more lousy that makes us feel. I mean, you can try an experiment after this. Cut up the first person and you will feel bad about it until you get back to a state of harmony with that person. So, Terry was saying there that every act is in a sense that altruism may not exist, that we do everything for ourselves, but I wonder what part of ourself it is. If it's for the selfish me, it will not make you happy. If it's for the deep ground of our being, for our soul, for our deepest part of ourselves, it will make us happy, because that part of ourself is in connection with every other person and indeed with nature around us. So, you could say it was a selfish thing. It's made me happy doing it and seeing it flourish and grow, Francesca.
I don't think selfish is the word, but that message will absolutely resonate with so many people who are on this call, I'm sure. I'm absolutely convinced of it. So I am now going to move the questions into a slightly quicker phase. That's all, just slightly quicker. I'm going to, Terry, turn to you. When I've read about you and listened to your interviews, and I have to say to both of you, it's been an absolute pleasure researching this. You talk about creativity, creative isolation, and imagination being so important to you through your captivity. And indeed, you've already mentioned that you composed books while you were in solitary confinement, which I find simply amazing. But how do you feel people can harness their creativity now to help them better cope with the current anxieties?
Well, I think that you can look at the present situation as being a real opportunity. Now, I do recognize that it is extremely difficult for some people for many reasons. If you're living in cramped circumstances alongside other people, that is difficult. And in that situation, I think it's important that at least you just try and make a little space for yourself. You need time for yourself. You need time to be alone. And my belief is that if you're able to be alone and live with yourself, you are far more able to be able to live with others. You're a better member of community. It's a question of balance. So I think that's one thing. I think the other one The other real difficulty is the real anxiety that some people will be facing now regarding the future. Is my job going to be secure? What's going to happen? Am I going to be out of work? Well, I've lived with that degree of security. Every day in captivity, I never knew whether or not I was going to see the end of that day. I mean, sometimes they came in and they'd take me out and, you know, I was tortured. I was faced a mock execution. And somehow I had to say, the real secret of this is living for now. Now you have life, this moment. Now you can do something. And in my life, I had, as I said earlier, develop a richer, fuller inner life. And that can be done in isolation. Learning something new each day. That's something, believe it or not, something rather frivolous and stupid, but something I'm doing. I've always wanted to play a musical instrument. And I've never got round to it. But I bought myself a ukulele. And I'm learning to play the ukulele with, and mercifully, no one has to listen to me. It's, you know, I sit there and strum it. But I'm also reading much more widely now. I've got piles of books which I've never read. So using this and saying this is a wonderful opportunity to catch up, to listen to music that I needed to listen to read that I, books that I haven't read, to learn something new, and to take each day and say, here is another opportunity for exploration and for developing and filling out that rich inner life, which will stand us in enormously good stead for when things return to what might be considered to be normal. And yet, in some ways, do I want them to be, to return to what was so-called normality? I want them to be new, fresh, adventurous, more compassionate, more understanding. I want them to be different. But if they're going to be different, then the difference has to start with me. I have to start the process now. And I've got the opportunity to do it now. Yeah. So that makes the difference.
And it mustn't be a wasted opportunity either, because please God, this doesn't happen on a regular basis. So thank you very much. The whole concept of living in the moment is absolutely coming through in everything you're both saying. Now, again, both of you have dedicated a large part of your lives to young people. Terry through Y Cares, and am I right in thinking you're writing a children's book at the moment?
Yeah, I've written it. It's been published. The Tales of Tommy Twitchnose.
Fabulous.
It's a book of children's stories, and I've written it because I wanted to write stories that would be interesting for the one who's reading them as well as for the children. So we'll see whether or not it comes off, but it's coming out this.
Anthony, of course, I know a lot of us listening will have real concerns for the impact that this current crisis is having and will have on young people. Could you share your thoughts on what this time in particular will have on schools, maybe further education? And ultimately, and very importantly, the mental well-being of our young people.
So again, we come back to the fact that we can do things about it. The only people in life who are victims are those who let themselves become victims. And if Terry Waite's life means one thing, there you have a supreme example of somebody who could have let themselves become a victim, but they took their life into their own hands and has come out with a message that truly enhances the universe as well as Terry himself. And wonderful to hear about Terry Twitchnose. And Terry, if there was one instrument that I would have, in my mind, I was imagining what it would be, it would have been the ukulele. Definitely, that is your definite instrument. And you know, creativity, Francesca, is at the heart. We used to think we had to teach children creativity. Wrong. My experience of a lifetime in schools, Brighton College and Wellington College and before, was that schools actually knock the stuffing and knock the creativity out of children. Children, you don't have to teach anyone who's had children, you don't teach your children how to dance and make plays and write their stories, that they are sizzling in creativity, and creativity is who and what we are. And what we need to do is to stop schools damaging and universities, young people, and let them become the unique human being. And when they become that, then that is mental wellness. And we need to, all of us, to be getting in touch with our own creativity as a sovereign path. So I mentioned earlier, GREAT DREAM, the acronym standing for 10 different actions. T in GREAT stands for trying things out. And what a great time this is, COVID now, for all of us trying different things out in our own lives. So, you know, we don't go back to, if we're allowed to have holidays again, necessarily back to the same places. We don't need to be with the same people. We're having the same conversations around dinner parties. I mean, the more we break out from ourselves, get in touch. I mean, make a note, everybody listening to this call now, write down 5 things that you either loved to do or that you've always wanted to do. I mean, it might, you know, it might be dancing. It might be writing poetry. It might be going somewhere in the world or reading Proust à la Recherche de Tom Perdu. I mean, whatever it is, make a note of it and do it. And the more we can renew ourselves by getting back to creativity, and that's what is true of children, that we try and homogenize children. We get them on exactly the same curriculum in the same year with the same exam structure. They are made to believe that they are a failure or a success if they get the A stars and the top grades. What our education, I mean, education means you lead out from what's inside. That's what the word educate, draw out. But actually what it is it's a narrowing down often to one narrow form of intelligence, which is a cognitive left brain intelligence. The best saying about education comes from the Harvard professor, Howard Gardner. He said, don't ask how intelligent a child is, or indeed an adult is. Ask rather, how is that child, that adult, intelligent? That we, all of us, everybody listening, everybody in the universe, has their unique intelligences, which are multifaceted. They could be social, interactive, emotional, creative, physical, sporting intelligence, moral, spiritual, intellectual, all the different kinds of intelligences, and a proper education system will draw all those out. And when we have that, we have mental health. So mental health is about living in harmony with us as we really are, doing the things that we want to be doing out of the ground of our own being. And we need, all of us, we're on a journey back to what we once were when we were the youngest children, when we were truly ourselves. And spontaneity, creativity, fun, laughter, play is all part of that. I mean, how often does everybody laugh? Are you laughing more during COVID or less? Laughter is a sovereign path to happiness.
Thank you. And I know that there will be a lot of people out there that will have been enthused by your enthusiasm and the ideas that were thrown out there, and then will also be frustrated at times of the challenge of when they find themselves homeschooling and trying to remember not to say something in a rather snitty voice, but rather to find the inner strength that they know is there for them. I've got some wonderful client questions coming in, so I'm going to have to sort of dodge around. The first one I'm going to ask is from Adrian. He says he employs many people worldwide from a broad range of culture, space and backgrounds. Helping their mental well-being and happiness is a privilege. while assisting the smooth running of my business. One element of this assistance that I challenge myself to understand is whether...
Alan, yes, I think the worst has happened. And I can see you.
I think good morning.
Yeah.
Good morning, Terry Anthony. As Francesca did say at the start, she may suddenly disappear on us, and that's happened. So I'm Alan Marshall, I'm at Coutts, and privilege again to continue. So I think we were asking a question from Adrian. I don't know whether you've got some of that. But Adrian was asking, he employs many people worldwide, and he understands that mental well-being is important in the smooth running of his business. But one element he challenges himself with is to understand whether there should be also a spiritual element in those discussions, or can true happiness and mental well-being be achieved without that? So I'll put that to Anthony first.
I would say that the higher... we go up a path from moving beyond pleasure through happiness, and the more our lives become joyful, the more we become spiritual, more connected with other people of all faiths and nationalities, types, ethnicities. So ultimately, our birthright is joy, and that is spiritual. And as Thoreau said, most men and women lead lives of quiet desperation and go to their graves with their song still inside them. But we can find our song, and the more we find our song, the more connected we become with ourselves and with other people, the more joyful we become. And yes, that is spiritual, I believe.
Thank you.
If I could respond to that, yeah. People have often said to me, because you have faith, how did that help, or was that a help in captivity? Well, I think the first thing to say about that is that I've never believed that if you have faith or belief, that you receive special protection, if you like. I think you take your chance alongside everybody else in this world. What I think it does, it enables you to have a framework or resources to make an exploration. A church is a framework, a religion is a framework. There are different frameworks in different cultures and different faiths. But part of the journey of life, as I understand it, is to begin to comprehend more fully the mystery that lies within and the mystery that lies beyond. And that mystery is sometimes called God. But the journey of faith is the journey of exploration into that mystery, which is both within and beyond ourselves. And the framework, to my mind, can be rather seen as a handrail. It's not the essence. It's a handrail which leads you towards that greater immersion and understanding of the mystery that is of life, that is of this world, that is of God. And I could say, because of faith in captivity, in the face of my captive, I could say, for example, you have the power to break my body and you've tried, the power to bend my mind and you've tried, but my soul is not yours to possess. Now, I've been hard pushed to define soul. But by that context, I meant the total person that I am. You will never possess me completely, because my person lies in the hand of God. And that's what I understand about the spiritual element.
And very quickly there, we... listening to this have not been in captivity and solitary confinement in Lebanon, but many people on earth are in confinement and captivity every person is mentally unwell, and the journey to freedom is a journey that we are all on out of our own captivities, often of our own creation, to a journey that is a life that is free and joyful and utterly in touch with others and with ourselves in harmony.
Absolutely,
yeah, thank you. We've got a question from Sarah. On the note of creativity, would you both be kind enough to share maybe a short quote that you could reflect on? Terry, I know you wrote a beautiful book of poetry, I believe. Maybe you've got a couple of lines you could inspire. And Anthony, could you share a bit of sort of creative exploration or a favourite quote? So Anthony first, have you got any sort of uplifting quotes or phrases you could share?
Well, I would come back, Alan, to the Thoreau about most men and women leading lives of quiet desperation and going to their grave with their song still inside them. And, you know, without wanting to be morbid, you know, we are all going to die, and to release our song and to see COVID as an opportunity for us to release, because it's meaning that we're having to be more thoughtful and reflective and considered. It's forcing our lives into an abrupt pause, to use this as the opportunity to connect and to think what really does matter. And often it is, you know, being with our children, with our families, with our friends, and the things that we've that deeply matter to us. And that's where you will find happiness and joy.
Thank you. And a question from Gail now. For you, Terry, is what sort of forms or of psychological therapies did you have after your ordeal, which you've very kindly shared with us here? And were there any that were helpful? And are there any lasting changes you've noted as a person since your ordeal? Do you mind sharing?
What I missed your point. What sort of what? Sorry. The first part, you...
Was any psychological therapies that got you through your ordeal? And
I see, yes. Well, coming out of that experience took time. And one of the things that I remember someone saying to me a long time ago was, if you come out of an experience of trauma, don't try and do things too quickly. It was likened to coming up from the seabed. If you've been on the seabed and you come up too quickly, you get the bends, you get nitrogen in the blood. And if you take it gently and slowly, you'll be fine. Now, I was very, very fortunate because I came out of that experience and was elected to a fellowship in Trinity Hall, Cambridge, which gave me opportunity to spend the day writing, to associate with my colleagues and gradually get back into life. And that was really a wonderful experience. I owe a tremendous debt to Cambridge for that privilege of being able to be with them at that point. And so I would say, and as in Hostage International, we spend a lot of time with people. I mean, and spend a lot of time just alongside them, and if they need specialized help, then we have a whole team of professional people who will do give their time on a pro bono basis to assisting them and supporting them. So I don't think one need be over worried that this particular period is going necessarily to lead to great needing therapy, but it'll take time again to readjust. And I know from what people are telling me, there is real anxiety in some people as to whether or not they're going to be able to pick up again once this is over, having had several weeks of comparatively isolation. And so with that understanding, take it gently, one step at a time.
Thank you very much, Terry. And shall I hand back to you, Francesca, now? We seem to have you back.
Thank you very much.
Live and working again. So thank you very much. Back to you.
Thank you. Can you just give me a clue where you are?
Yes, we asked a question from Gail on psychological therapies, and the next question I think will be from either Dorothy or Peter.
Well, I think given the time, we're going to ask Peter's question, please. I'm going to direct this to Anthony. You've written biographies, as we mentioned, of a number of prime ministers. With your intimate knowledge of these leaders, who do you think would have led us best through this current pandemic?
Peter, here's a thought. I think if Boris Johnson had become Prime Minister in 2016, as he might well have done if he and Michael Gove didn't stab themselves, he would have provided a more decisive and optimistic and ebullient leadership to oversee the Brexit negotiations, whatever one thinks of that. And I think Theresa May, with her calm, diligent, steady approach, mastery of detail, could well have been the right person. She was an outstanding Home Secretary. So in a way, it's slightly unfortunate, perhaps those two were the wrong way around.
Thank you. Thank you. So my last question to you, please, for a very brief answer. There's no doubt that there is more fear around in the world today, and you've given us some fantastic thoughts into how to help ourselves with that. Can you share what you feel optimistic about at this time? What are the key things that are carrying you through? We heard from Terry a little bit about the reappreciation of what a phenomenal world we live in. Terry.
Well, yeah, if I can answer that indirectly, I quote a little bit. I was asked earlier and I couldn't find it, but a little quote from the end. This is the end of a poem I've written in the book, Out of the Silence. And it probably is a bit of guidance for me for the future. Be still, listen to the inner voice, learn to love, let compassion guide your actions, walk calmly through the mists of unknowing. The kingdom is yours.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you very much. Anthony.
Well, that's very moving indeed, isn't it? I'm going to meditate and reflect on that, Terry. Optimism, Francesca. We will get through this. We know we're going to. And I think that it has, for all the terror and the sadness and the loss in so many homes, it has helped to reboot us. I think that too many of us, myself included, lost touch with what really mattered in life. It is the word Terry used there, love. I mean, love is all that endures, as a poet said, to be with ourselves, with our families, to be in nature, to be creative, to be trying music, to be painting, to be dancing without anybody, including our children, ridiculing ourselves for dancing, putting on our favourite tunes, to find the spontaneity, the creativity, the joy, the abandon, the freedom. All these are good things, and to accept ourselves, you know. And there'll be some people listening who have been battling educating their children. Stop trying to be the best. Just be good enough, you know, and accept yourself as you are. And that word acceptance is probably the word I'd finish on. It's one of the great dream in that acronym, acceptance. And the more we can just accept ourselves and others and be optimistic, we're going to get through this. And life is going to be better.
And remember also, if you've tried everything, as a last resort, there's always the ukulele.
Definitely. everyone, we should start a ukulele band. Everyone.
If we'd known this, Terry, we would have had
to ukulele band.
But let me thank you both for sharing these wonderful insights and for helping to inspire us today. and hopefully making everybody a little bit happier on this beautiful Thursday. A very special thank you to everybody who's joined in the call today and for sharing your questions. My apologies about falling off. Nothing I could do about it. Our next Coots in Conversation will be coming quick on the heels of this one. Next Friday, the 28th of May, we will be hosting Professor Sir John Bell, who is Regius Professor of Medicine at University of Oxford. So please look out for the invite that's being sent later today. Thank you to our guests. Thank you to everybody who's joined the call, and to everybody, stay safe. Goodbye.
Bye.